All right, so as always, let me start by asking if you have questions from things we did last week. Yeah.
So I had a question about patents. I know one of the readings talked about the difference between, well, they said biotech in particular is in danger of creating antibodies, so I really didn't understand that. This article never really clarified why it's particularly biotech rather than any other field.
Yeah. Don't know. I don't know enough about biotech, but that is the reason you would expect to happen would be if you had a case where, in order to do things, you needed lots of separate inventions, all of which were patented by different people. And I could see that argument in a number of fields, but I don't know why it's more true in biotech than anywhere else. It's not my field. Other? All right, I was going to start with something which I noticed sort of going through the reading. It wasn't very major, but it intrigued me because it was a point that fit both my moral intuition and some reading I've been doing for my other seminar about early Irish law, oddly enough. And I always like it when things like that go together. And that was a suggestion that one possible basis for fair use, which is one of the things we'll be talking about today, is my violating your copyright in a way you would approve of, in a way which doesn't make you worse off and maybe makes you better off. And the comment said you can't actually explain existing law that way because, after all, parody and critical sites are also considered fair use, and the person who's being parodied or criticized probably isn't in favor of that. But it does fit my own intuition, because let me give you the case where I think it's occasionally arisen. I have a computer game. Computer game is copyrighted. I don't have the legal right to make copies. I have a friend who I trust, who I believe is an honest person, and he's interested in the game. So I say, well, look, I'll give you a copy of the game. Play it for a week. If you decide you don't like it, wipe it off. And if you do like it, buy one. And assuming that I trust him, assuming I believe he'll do that, I would feel that was a legitimate thing to do, even though it happens to be illegal. And I would feel it was legitimate on the grounds that I believe that if I could go to the copyright holder and say I want to do this, his reaction would be fine. And I guess I feel a little bit more this way because I'm a copyright holder myself, and I know how I feel about analogous things. That in fact, I mean, going further, when I discovered that my first book had been pirated and up on the web, I felt obliged to tell my publisher because they officially held the copyright, but I didn't actually feel angry at the person who had done it. And it went, disappeared and then reappeared, and I didn't tell my publisher the second time because I figured that enforcing the copyright they currently held was their job, not mine. I did download a copy, and eventually when my publisher gave me permission to web the book myself, I put up the pirated copy on my webpage. I pirated the pirate, saving me the trouble of digitizing the thing. So I guess partly I feel more willing to do that because I feel as though I'm on sort of both sides of that game. But in general, it seems sort of to me legitimate to say that in cases where nobody is worse off, I can ignore the law. And one of the things I want to be talking about a little later today is the whole issue of different people's intuitions of what constrains them, to what extent you're constrained by what's moral, to what extent by what's legal, and so forth. Because that's part of one of the issues that's coming up in some of the readings here. But it then occurred to me that I've been reading up on early Irish law from my legal system's very different class. And early Irish law has very complicated contract law. And part of what complicates it is that my contract with you might affect my ability to fulfill my obligations to her. So that, for example, a son is obliged to support his parents when they get old. So under some circumstances, a father can cancel the son's contract on the grounds that that contract may make it harder for the son to fulfill his obligation to the father. And there are a whole bunch of things. It was a fairly sort of interrelated society, so that much land was held jointly by a kin group, and at a given time, one person divided up but then got redivided over the generations. There were circumstances in which the members of your kin group could cancel your contracts, or in which you could only make a contract with their permission. Ditto between husband and wife, that husband and wife had certain obligations to each other. Quite complicated in that case, because Irish law, surprisingly, is fairly symmetrical between men and women, in the sense that they have three categories of marriage, according to who provided most of the assets for the married couple. So there's marriage on man's property, there's marriage on woman's property, and there's marriage on joint property. Now, I presume, though I may be wrong, that it was usually marriage on man's property. I'm not sure we know enough to be sure of that. But legally speaking, it was symmetrical, that basically, if it was marriage on man's property, the husband had a lot of rights to cancel the wife's contracts, and the wife very limited rights for the husband. Reverses when it's marriage on women's property. That was sort of neat. But it just occurred to me then that there's an exception or a special rule which applies to many of these cases, which is that I can't cancel an advantageous contract. I can't cancel a contract which clearly makes you better able to fulfill your obligations. All right? So that if my son makes a contract to do something, and it's clear, and I don't know what clear means, it's not clear exactly how these disputes are getting settled, but at least in terms of the written law, or written law cases, they didn't have statute law. This is all somebody's description of customary law, basically, that I can't cancel my son's contract if it is clear that it is a mutually advantageous contract. That is a contract which can't end up leaving him in a worse position to support me. And that actually was sort of reminded me of my moral intuition here, that those cases which sort of are win-win cases for both sides, the legal restrictions disappear that would otherwise exist. And so it's not exactly the same, it's sort of law versus morality, but that my feeling is that the restriction on me not to violate somebody's copyright disappears in the case where I'm pretty confident that he and I are both better off when I do it, just as those restrictions. Well, that was sort of intriguing and sort of fed into this sort of long discussion, because a lot of the sort of first reading is really on how you make sense of fair use, where you've really got, it seems to me, several different pretty independent theories of fair use, along with variants on that idea. So you sort of start out with, here are the four criteria, here's how they all make sense, and at that point, the judge who's writing there is assuming that the only question is, to what extent does it serve the purposes of copyright? So he is saying that if my potentially infringing use in various ways, there's what's the purpose of copyright? Basically to encourage the production and reading and use of written material. We think of ordinary copyright on books and such. That's, I'm not sure he put to encourage the science and useful arts, but science had a somewhat different meaning then than it does now. So his view basically is, if I am infringing in a way which tends to further those objectives, and if my infringement doesn't hurt you very much and therefore doesn't very much reduce your incentive to write books. So he's looking at it all in terms of, we've got a single maximam, which is sort of fuzzily defined, but it's something, think of it very loosely as production of literature, although that's too narrow a statement. And that if my infringement promotes that, then fair use will be designed to let me do it. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That's it. That's sort of the end of it. And all of the different four criteria can be seen as different elements in whether or not that's true. Is that a fair statement? What? Yes? That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking about the view of our first reading of whichever that judge was, Laval, I think, of it.
And whether it's accurate of how judge.
Whether he's right or not is a separate question. So we're getting multiple perspectives, both on what the law is and on what it should be. And I was just trying to sum up what it seems to me is one of those views. I think the first reading, if I remember for today, which was a judge who's, was Laval, right? Whatever his name was anyway, a judge who was describing how he interpreted it. And he saw it, that's the basic problem, is that the law specifies some criteria but gives you no way of adding them up. So you don't know, and this is sort of a fairly obvious problem of how you know whether you've engaged in fair use, and the real answer is you don't know if you've engaged in fair use. You know, maybe are you more or less likely to be held fair use, and so he was saying that he thought that in principle the reason for all of this and therefore the basis of fair use was, does it promote the objectives of the copyright law? And I think that other people agree that that's a fair summary of his view. The next question is, does it make any sense? That is that a sensible? Now you're forget about whether it fits the law. You're in Congress. You're trying to design the law. Is there any particular reason you would design it that way?
Well,
All right. What, after all, if your infringing use does not serve the objectives of copyright, but serves other important objectives? All right. How am I going to infringe? Well, you wrote a book. It's such an outrageous book. You happen to be a politician, and so am I. In fact, we're running against each other. Your book is so outrageous that anybody who reads the appropriate chunks of it will vote against you. So I make unlicensed copies of the relevant chunks of your book and spread them broadcast about the electorate. I'm not trying to increase the amount of literature. All right? In fact, I'm decreasing it because other politicians will sensibly say we better not write books because this could happen to us too. All right? In my view, sort of, you know, one of the reasons that Bork never made it to the Supreme Court and one of the reasons that Posner will probably never make it to the Supreme Court is they write too many books, they write too many articles, they do things that people can attack. So it's not, but it's serving another useful purpose. It's preventing a bad guy from getting elected. You can think of lots of other examples. That just is one that occurred to me. So the question is, does it make any sense to say we will decide when we don't enforce our copyright rule only on the objectives of copyright? Or ought you to be saying something more like, we will not enforce our copyright rule when we believe that not enforcing it produces better results than enforcing it? And maybe we will try to think up some set of criteria that will let us figure out when that's true. It's going to be very hard to do. But it did seem to me that sort of puzzle of how you were designing the law was there at the beginning, and that the reading at least just took it for granted that the right thing was. Comments? Yeah?
I guess one thing that I do not agree with the law is that, I guess, it's in the towards the end of it, fair use is not a creature of equity, which I don't know. I guess maybe without I'm really understanding.
How much do people know about the law equity distinction? The distinction between law and equity.
Yeah. How much do I know?
How much do you know?
I guess when I see equity, I guess I don't know.
Do you know that they were, in fact, two different parts of the English common law? The English, in English law, you had something called law, you had something called equity, which was sort of competing with law in some sense, two different approaches for getting rights and for getting results. All right, you're familiar with that, because I don't know how many people here, I mean, they're technical terms, and equity sounds like it just means something like fairness, and it's got a much narrower meaning. So then, What survives in modern American law of that distinction? In U.S. Civil law, yeah. That there survives a distinction that the typical law remedy is a damage payment, whereas equity remedies can be injunctions, they can even be specific performance in principle, and that's a survival from the time when there were separate courts of law and equity both in the UK and in the US. So I'd have to look at what he said, but I think that one of the distinctions which people are raising here, and which comes a number of people are touching on, is whether the appropriate remedy ought to be an injunction or ought to be money damages. And that's a point. Kaczynski makes an argument for money damages at one point, and I think one of the other people is making that argument. Now, a different issue is that sort of underlying conceptual idea of the distinction was something like, and I'm not sure I've got it right, that law is a mechanical system which says if you do this according to the right rules, this happens. That it was perceived early on that sometimes the rules resulted in very poor results. That there were cases where you were clearly legally in the right, but there was no hole your peg fit into, so to speak, and therefore you couldn't get what you wanted through the law system. And then equity develops, in some sense, theoretically to fix that. So conceptually, there's some tendency to think of a distinction as between fitting the formal rules on the one hand and somehow feeling just on the other. And there was actually a real tug of war for a while where you have people basically losing a case in law and then winning and getting the equity court to forbid the other party from collecting the damage payment with an injunction, essentially. And there was sort of a real question as to who won over whom. in that case. So I'd have to look at the passage. But my guess is that when a modern writer uses the term equity, either he's thinking of the distinction of equitable remedies versus law remedies, or possibly of the distinction between does this fit the rules versus does it feel right. And you certainly see that distinction because Laval is pretty, I don't remember whether it's when he brings in equity or not, but he's explicitly saying, and I guess the next writer is saying exactly the opposite, but what he's saying is this isn't an issue of whether you've acted badly or well. That here are our criteria, check them off, see whether the net effect is that what you're doing promotes or hinders the objectives of copyright law. If you happen to be an SOB, well, SOBs can promote the objectives of copyright law. You know, if the way you got access to the stuff you publish, you know, imagine, go back to my politician case. Let us suppose that what I'm publishing and spreading about the district is not public information, but is stuff from the politician's file that I got his servant to photocopy and send me. All right, that's bad behavior. It would give me real trouble in a trade secret context. But you could argue, and I think Laval is arguing, maybe his servant should be jailed or sued or something. Maybe I should be jailed, but not for copyright infringement, that the copyright system should only be for this one purpose. And I think that's, in a sense, the form of the argument he's making. And we then have Weinreb, I guess, is the next one, who says just the opposite. That Weinreb says, you know, these criteria are all very well, but we really ought to incorporate judgments of fairness, of justice, behavior we approve of or don't approve of into our decision of what's, yeah.
How did the equity clause just kind of
seem? I think at one point what happens is they merge, so you have one court which is deciding some questions as matters of law and some of equity. I think, though I am not certain, that there are still a few U.S. states that actually have separate courts and certainly separate doctrines of equity and law. So they're different parts of the common law, in effect. But I think at least if you go back, say, to 17th or 18th century England, it actually mattered a good deal whether you tried to get your case into a law court or into an equity court, because you might get different results according to those. But I'm not really an expert in the history of the English common law, which I suspect would be a fun thing to know more about. It's entirely a digression, but it was an interesting digression. There was a piece I read at some point, I mentioned it to you, discussing the relation between how judges were paid and which side they were biased towards. Because it was a situation, if I remember correctly, I think what was going on was, this is English courts at some point like 1819, somewhere around there, where judges were being paid essentially according to how many cases they decided, where it was the plaintiff who chose the court, given some variety of possible courts. And the argument was that gave judges an incentive to be pro-plaintiff in order that plaintiffs would choose their court to be tried in. And then at some point they change the rule so that the judges, I don't know if it's a fixed salary, but it's the salary no longer depends on the number of cases. Now, of course, this reverses the incentive, because if judges are lazy, they'd like to have as few cases as possible. And the claim was that you, in fact, get an observed shift to a more pro-defendant result. And I cannot give you the site, because I'm just remembering something that I read, but I thought it was a really neat piece of a sort one doesn't see enough of trying to think about how those incentives actually work and how they actually affect things. But in a way, this is really a narrower version of the point I started with. That is to say, my point was, why do we limit it to the objectives of copyright law, where I was thinking of all possible desirable objectives, whereas what Weinreb is saying is not quite all possible objectives, but one of our objectives is promoting literature. Another objective is to getting people to behave well. And it's not very clear exactly what behave well means, but he thinks that, therefore, it's legitimate that we are less willing to count it as fair use when you stole the information, quite aside from whether or not you can be prosecuted in criminal law or civil law for stealing the information. And presumably, any feelings on this? Is he right? Is he wrong? Or, yeah?
I mean, just my inclination is that there is a bit of morality in the fair use doctrine. That's why when I read the initial essay,
yeah.
the ball, I was a little bit, it was a little taken aback.
Yes.
But it wasn't.
Yes. So what is the morality in it? From your state, that is it a copyright morality or a general morality? Or?
I don't know if I can see the law to back it up. But
yeah.
I know one of the
moral intuitions are interesting because that's one of the things going on in some of these readings, really, if you look at it. This goes all the way back to Macaulay. Right? Macaulay says, look, one of the reasons you shouldn't extend the copyright law is then people won't believe it's morally justified. And since they don't believe it's morally justified, they won't obey it, and that'll be a real mess. And one of our readings here, I think it's Lippmann, if I remember correctly, is saying the same thing, essentially, with regard to modern high-tech copyright law. She's saying, now, I don't know if either of them is right. I think Macaulay is a much better orator than an economist or than a theorist. I don't see any very strong reason to believe that changing from 30 years to 60 years would have the effect he says. But it's an interesting point. And I think it's quite a general point that let me go back a bit to a bit of my own intellectual history. And that is, a very long time ago, I concluded that I didn't see any reason why laws were morally binding. It didn't seem to me that right and wrong was made by act of Congress. At the same time, I also thought that a human society couldn't function unless people thought laws were binding, because there would never be enough police to enforce the laws. And so for quite a while, this was before I went to college, so I think I reached the conclusion about 15 or so. And so my resolution at the time was that I would myself obey laws on the grounds that there might be a good reason why they were binding, even if I hadn't thought of one, until I could resolve the matter. And I acted that way for a few years. And then I noticed everybody else thought I was nuts, because nobody else acted that way. That everybody else assumed that if you were 18 and allowed to buy wine, it was perfectly legitimate to offer your 17-year-old friend a glass of wine. And if you were driving and the speed limit was 50 miles an hour and there was no traffic and it was obviously perfectly safe, 55 miles an hour is just fine. And that as far as I was the only person in the world who was trying to act as if laws were morally binding, and yet my society hadn't collapsed. So I had to have been wrong in my initial presumption. It couldn't be the case that society's functioning depended on most of the people actually believing they're morally bound to obey all laws. And my conclusion is that what it actually depends on is some mix of laws that people think they're morally obliged to obey, whether or not they're laws, like laws against murder, risk of getting caught, and some laws not getting obeyed and the society not collapsing anyway. And so since then, I have felt no obligation to obey laws, except when they are laws that are morally justified. At a further tangent, I just saw an interesting discussion on a blog which started with a quote from a judge, it turned out, basically about what a morally dubious thing it was being a judge. This was a long-term judge, and he was basically saying, if you're thinking about being a judge, think about the fact that you will be in a situation where your job is to condemn somebody to a very serious punishment, which you don't think he deserves, because you're deciding according to what the law says, not what you believe. And you get very interesting comments on that, because sort of, the comment on one side is, if you're not willing to enforce the law, you shouldn't be a judge. The comment on the other side is, if you're willing to enforce a thoroughly unjust law, you not only shouldn't be a judge, you shouldn't be a human being. All right? So that's a sort of an interesting, and it's an issue that some of you someday may have to face. There's a certain sense in which I've had to face it in a very small way when I was up for jury duty. All right? Suppose you are up for jury duty, and it is reasonably clear the defendant is being charged with something that you think shouldn't be a crime. All right? Well, you have three choices. You can go on the jury and enforce the law. You can go on the jury and deliberately subvert the law, what's referred to as jury nullification. Or you can tell the judge, when the judge asks you, I'm sorry, I cannot obey your instructions in this case, because I think it's an immoral law, so I would vote for nullification, then the judge won't put you on the jury. The last is essentially what I did when I was in that situation, but I'm not sure I was right, because that might mean that an innocent person ended up in jail. And maybe I should have been willing to lie to the judge. I think that was the case that the judge was actually an SCU graduate, which made it, I guess, a little bit harder for no very good reason. And it also may be that that law professors are unlikely to end up on juries anyway for various reasons. But it did strike me as an interesting moral problem. And it's connected with the whole question of how you feel about the moral status of law, because the sort of the official doctrine is you're morally obliged to obey law. The actual behavior of human beings implies they don't act as if they really believe that, and you're sort of caught in between. Is it that you should feel guilty about it, or is there some fancier version in which you should mostly feel obliged to obey laws? I mean, one of the points that I think it's Lippmann makes is there are some laws people don't really believe in. And she's a little bit fuzzy as to whether she means they don't actually think that's the law, or they think, well, that's what the law book says, but nobody really does it. So anyway, but those are, excuse me, are a set of intriguing questions that you even more than me ought to worry about, since you are going to be lawyers, and I think the chance that I will ever be a judge is for all purpose, practical purposes, zero. Whereas it wouldn't be surprising if one or two of you ended up as judges, and of course all of us have a risk of ending up on a jury someday. I think the only, arguably the only form of slavery that survives in our society, well, I guess prison slavery too, but jury slavery, because after all, in theory, it's compulsory, right? In practice, it isn't. That is, as far as I can tell, it is pretty easy, if you don't want to be on the jury, to give answers to questions that will result in you not being on the jury. But at least in theory, you don't have that option. So it really is a form of state slavery. Maybe desirable. I mean, you can obviously make arguments for it. But so anyway, I want to go back, though, to my initial question, which I've got in my notes, is why segregate purposes? Why evaluate the exception to copyright law only in terms of the objectives of copyright law? And I'm wondering, can people think of other examples where that's happening, about elsewhere in the legal system, where you say, well, we've got this law which has a certain purpose, and we'll make exceptions to the law where the exception serves that purpose, not where the exception is a good thing. Are there other examples? I didn't think of any other examples, but I was wondering, since you've all been spending your time studying the law, if any occurred to you. No. Do you think about one? Yep.
I mean, I guess when you have self-defense exceptions to killing.
So self-defense exception, the justification, is the justification of the self-defense exception the idea that it reduces murder because people will be less willing to try to kill people if they might get killed in the process?
I was thinking about the overall defense.
So that one could, yeah, I suppose one could, but then one could also say that the justification for that is that I can think of two other justifications. One of them is, if you know you're going to get killed if you don't shoot somebody, even if you're going to go to prison, you're going to shoot him. So what's the point? You can't deter that. That's not a very good argument, though, because there are a lot of intermediate cases where, you know, you might get killed if you don't, and you might not. And there might even be cases where you know you won't get killed, but you can persuade a court you will, and therefore. So, and a different argument would be a moral argument that I think a lot of people sort of feel, well, it's just to kill if someone's trying to kill you. And that, yeah, I was thinking actually, your comment made me think about gun laws of various sorts. And if you think about, people say you want restrictions on ownership of guns in order to keep down crime. And you say, well, suppose you're against the restrictions. Is the only argument you're allowed to use that the restrictions result in increasing crime? You can make that argument, and a lot of people do argue, it may well be true, that private ownership of firearms prevents many more crimes than it creates because the criminal knows it's risky and so forth and so on. Might be true. But you also say, yeah, but firearms are also used for hunting, for target practice. And it seems to me that in that argument, all of those are considered legitimate arguments. You don't have to confine yourself to the particular, you're opposing a law, say a law forbidding people to own handguns or something. In opposing that, you don't feel obliged to only say this law will subvert its own purposes. You can also say this law might achieve its purposes, but will subvert other good purposes. So I don't know if there are other clear cases. And I'm not sure it's true of copyright law, but I mean, obviously, Weinberg is arguing it isn't. Suppose you wanted to defend doing that, whether in this case or any other. Somebody says, here is a law, we're going to have some narrow exceptions to it. What should we base the exceptions on? And you say, we should base the exceptions on whether the exception promotes the purpose of the law. How would you try to justify that action? Anybody? You're going to be in the business of justifying arguments, at least some of you, the ones who end up in the trials in another few years with luck. The argument that I would make would be that evaluating all possible effects is much too hard. and that we're therefore narrowing down the permissible rules, as it were. Think about things like the rule against hearsay. It's not that hearsay isn't evidence. It's just that it's evidence that it's hard to evaluate, and therefore the cost of including in your calculation is just too high. And it seems to me there are an awful lot of cases. I mean, let me go back to my field, which is economics. Economists often work with a simplified model of human behavior. And why do they do that? Because a model of human behavior that includes all the complications will be unworkably tangled. You never reach any conclusions. Whereas if you say, well, look, basically what humans are doing is trying to achieve their objectives. And basically humans are rational and tend to choose the acts that achieve their objectives. Now we can get somewhere. We say, well, basically humans are rational, except sometimes they aren't, because gets more and more tangled and harder. So it seems to me it's not that Laval's position is not an absurd or indefensible position, but I think it's a position that he ought to have explicitly defended. Maybe he does somewhere else, but it's not obvious that that's the right way to do it. And of course, a further point is, suppose we took the other side. Suppose we say fair use is any violation of copyright that on net produces good effects. We now have a real problem. How do we define good effects? All right. Now, economists have an answer to that. We've got this concept of economic efficiency, which is an attempt to measure the degree to which everybody in the society gets what he wants. It's not a very good measure, but it's as good a measure as we've got of that. But a lot of people won't accept that. I mean, I'm not sure anybody would fully accept that. Have I gone through the standard philosopher's counterexamples to sort of consequentialism or utilitarian here? The cutting somebody up for transplants? Oh. Did I mention that one? Yeah, all right. It's the doctor has got 5 patients. One of them is currently under anesthetic, but after examining, there's nothing wrong with him. Each of the other 4 has something wrong that would be cured by a transplant. One of them needs a new heart, one of them needs a new liver, and so forth. Should the doctor pretend the first one has a lethal thing, cut him up, and save 4 lives if it cost him 1, and everybody's feeling he shouldn't? Even though it looks as though a sort of an economic efficiency, a utilitarian, a consequentialist scheme seems to say he should. So that would be an example where we don't. So a different argument that Laval could make is to say, well, yes, it would be nice if we all agreed about what was good, but we don't. But we all agree that the objectives of the copyright law are good. So let's limit ourselves to whether we should. So it seems to me those are possible ways you could defend what he's doing, and it might be interesting if he had done so. One of the issues that's arising here, let me go back to a distinction which applies across law in general. And that's in particular, going back to what we were just saying, it applies to law versus equity. And that's the difference between a rule and a standard. All right? So it is illegal to drive more than 55 miles an hour as a rule. It is illegal to drive in a dangerous manner as a standard. And there are obviously advantages to both. All right? The trouble with a rule is it's often wrong. That in fact, given that it's pouring rain, heavy traffic, and nighttime, 55 miles an hour is dangerous and you shouldn't be allowed to do it. Whereas, beautiful day, empty highway, daylight, overcast so the sun can't get in your eyes, 65 is perfectly safe. So, on the other hand, if you have the standard, now someone's got to decide whether or not you violated it, and first, it may be hard to do. Second, we may not trust people who are making the decision. They may decide people I like, 75 is perfectly safe. People I don't like, 45 is dangerous. So there are advantages and disadvantages both ways. So one possible, in a sense, one complaint about fair use is that it's a standard masquerading as a rule. That because there isn't any clear explanation of how we add up these various factors, it really ends up, but maybe it has to be, because if you think of if we get to different accounts of the objective. Actually, let me go on now to Wendy Gordon's version, which is basically a summary of more or less the standard economist's version. It's not that different from what mine would be, although it wouldn't be exactly the same. And that version starts out with the idea that the whole reason to have copyright law is that we've got this problem of producing public goods. You're producing a good such that if you produce it, a bunch of people will benefit. And you can't control who benefits, and therefore you can't charge for it. And you can think of lots of examples of that sort of behavior. National defense is a standard example. We don't have a way of only stopping the missiles that are aiming at me and not the ones that are aiming at you. So therefore, if I pay for an anti-missile system or for an army to defend the border, I'm protecting you too, so why should you pay? And that's a standard problem. And there are various imperfect private ways of producing public goods. Lots of public goods, in fact, get produced privately. On the other hand, there aren't any reliable ways, and one solution is how the government produces it. And Wendy says, well, that's a fine solution in many cases. That's how we do national defense. But the case of literature, we have special reasons not to want the government deciding what books get written, because we don't trust the government to do it, given that whoever was currently controlling the administration has got their own axes they want to grind and their own views they want to promote or prevent being promoted. So alternative method is this clever idea of copyright, in which we give a monopoly to the producer, to the author. And that looks like a pretty good way. His reward is going to roughly reflect how much other people like what he's doing. And the government doesn't have to make any decisions about what's good or bad. We're going to come back to that later, because if you look at some of the other readings, the government really is making decisions about what's good or bad, which is one problem with some of them. But in any case, that's her. But now she says we have a problem. And this problem is market failure, which I think I've discussed before. The problem is, in a perfectly functioning market with no transaction costs, the monopoly given by IP would have no deadweight burden at all. Because in the perfectly functioning market, to begin with, if the right to get a copy of my book is worth a dollar to you and 20 cents to you, I don't charge a dollar and lose your sale. I charge you 99 cents and her 19 cents. All right. That would be a perfectly functioning zero transaction cost market. We don't have that market. Furthermore, that problem we sort of live with, the fact that we're going to have some deadweight burden due to the fact that the low-value customers don't get it because I'm trying to price for people who value it more. But then there's the further problem of all the people who want to use it in ways that require additional contracts. They don't just want to buy my book, which they can do paying me my royalties via my publisher. They want to take a chapter of my book and include it in their casebook in their reader. They want to quote a paragraph from my book. They want to write a sequel to my novel because they've got this. They really like my novel and they figured out what happens next. And they want to tell everybody, perfectly natural with human desire, right? There's a book by somebody who later wrote some quite interesting science fiction, but it's a book about Alexander the Great. And it's clear reading it, especially if you've read Mary Renault's 3-volume historical novel on Alexander, which I recommend, it's very good, that this is somebody who had exactly the same reaction that everybody else has to reading the history of Alexander, which is they got the ending wrong. He wasn't supposed to die. And so she fixed it. So she wrote her alternate history, one where he doesn't die. And by now, we're settled on the moon, if I remember correctly. Basically, Alexander establishes a Greek-Persian empire, which survives to the present day, more or less. And therefore, there's much more progress, and everything goes very nicely. Quite a neat book. Don't remember the title, but I can probably figure it if somebody's curious enough. Her other really good book is called The Game Beyond. And what's neat about it, it's a science fiction novel in which, as in many science fiction novel, you have a sort of a far future feudalism with it. The only difference is that, unlike everybody else, she's thought about why. So that in hers, she's figured out what were the conditions that led to this. And you gradually realize as you read the book that this rather attractive feudal system is breaking down. And it's breaking down because the conditions that caused it to come into existence are no longer there anymore. So that's called The Game Beyond. So if you look that up, you can figure out who the author is, whose name I've forgotten. Anyway, all right, so I want to use your intellectual property in some way, and then the argument is that in some cases the transaction costs of my doing so are unreasonably high, and therefore it makes more sense just to say, well, I'm allowed to do it without your permission. Furthermore, that's one set. That's the sort of the easier set. It certainly makes sense if you think about orphaned works, if you think about the case where I don't know who owns the copyright, and besides, the book's out of print, so it's not costing him any money if I print mine. And it's true that in principle, if the book's out of print, the copyright owner could still say to me, yes, but I'm losing the money, you'd be willing to pay me for permission to copy it, but if I can't find them, I'm probably not going to do that anyway, so, and so forth. That's one argument. And then she suggests some other possible arguments, which are, again, a little bit more iffy, which are, suppose you're you, it's not that the transaction cost with the copyright holder is a problem, it's that your use produces benefits that you can't capture. So, your use is a criticism of my book, this produces benefits for all the people who therefore realize they shouldn't bother to read my book. For some reason, I'm not very happy about that particular kind of benefit, so I would charge you a high price to give you permission to do that, but you won't pay a high price because you can't collect for that benefit. So that she's sort of taking standard kind of economic arguments of various forms of market failure, the good economist's first approximation is the market solves everything. And then the interesting stuff is why it doesn't. The interesting stuff is seeing what are the various ways in which that very elegant model of decentralized coordination breaks down. It works better than you would expect, otherwise we'd all be dead, right? I mean, if you try to imagine actually organizing a modern society by top-down command, it's very hard to see how it could work. So in that sense, the decentralized system works, but it doesn't work as well as you'd like it, and it's worth figuring out why. So that's basically her version. And of course, in her version, everything counts, right? In her version, she's an economist, or at least I don't know if Wendy's background is economist, but she's writing as an economist there at least. And so really economic efficiency or something like that is the relevant criterion. And the fact that the book doesn't contribute to literature, people really like reading it, or that it helps keep bad guys from getting elected to Congress, or whatever it does, all of those things count from that standpoint, which seems like a reasonable enough. So one of the things that's showing up in a lot of this, again, for the nth time in this course, is the whole natural rights versus consequentialist mechanism dispute over copyright, or over IP in general. Because if you're thinking of it as she is thinking of it, as this just a mechanism designed to produce results, well, there's nothing wrong with my violating your copyright if it produces good results. Whereas if you say, no, it's just like my enslaving you for a day if it produces good results. We should be dubious about that even if we think it produces good results. Then you get a different result. Number of points that are suggested, it seems to me, by her discussion. One of them is, should the fact that a work is not in print automatically be a defense? Should, if it's not in print and there are no plans to bring it into print, should anybody be free to pirate it? All right? It's not clear that there are any very, some cost, because maybe they could charge you for doing it, but if you imagine a case where, in fact, the copyright holder is getting no revenue from the book, hasn't been for quite a while, you might argue that it makes much more sense to let anybody else reproduce it who wants. We do that as long as it's whatever, 90 years or something after the copyright owner died or whatever the rule is, but we don't do that short of that. Maybe we should. Now, I think, if I've got it right, I think Wendy wrote at a point when there was still a registration requirement in U.S. copyright law, because she's assuming it exists. And so that's another question. Putting aside the problem of getting consistent with the Berne Convention, ought we to have registration? Indeed, ought one to have some rule which amounts to saying you can only enforce your copyright if people can find out how to find you? All right? And you can certainly imagine, if you think about it with the modern high-tech world, that there ought to be fairly easy ways of doing that, right? Suppose that, I mean, we don't even have to limit it to copyright registration. Suppose my defense is as follows. First, I checked and there was no registered copyright for the work I wanted to copy. Second, I did an extensive Google search with all the right keywords and I couldn't find it. Well, that's it. Now I get to copy it. Or you could imagine having, I don't know, for all I know, I don't know how they do registry of copyrights nowadays. You can still register copyright, as you may know. Basically, registering it gives you more legal rights. I think, again, some of you probably know this better than I do, but I think the distinction is that if your copyright is not registered, you can only collect for actual damages, whereas if it is registered, you can collect for statutory damages. So if they aren't really hurting you, but you want to get money, you want it to be registered, or aren't hurting you very much, or can't demonstrate they're hurting you very much. Other than the Berne Convention, is there any good reason to have our present rule in which you can enforce the copyright without taking any effort at all to make sure people can find out who owns it? Got any opinions on that one? Yes, no, maybe. All right. Because the only argument I know is that I gather Berne Convention requires it, and I don't know why the argument is for why the Berne Convention should require it. Because only one could try to persuade them. Let me take a different side of it, which really, in a sense, comes up later as well. Does the existence of the Internet, should the existence of the Internet reduce the range of the fair use defense? Suppose I say, look, I was actually in the situation 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that there was a 13th century cookbook written in Arabic, which somebody had translated at least part of it into Spanish, and I wanted to be able to make a retranslation into English available to other people who shared my interest in historical cooking. But I couldn't find a way of contacting, doing the original Arabic to Spanish translation. His copyright covers his work and there covers the derivative work, which is the retranslation. I couldn't find the copyright holder. Happened twice, actually. One of the cases, I got somebody who read medieval Arabic to do a retranslation of the original, which solved the problem. The other case, I didn't. But nowadays, if all of this had happened 30 years later, I bet I could find that copyright holder. Because I'd go up on Google, right? And 15 minutes, maybe. Well, you could argue that as it becomes, that the transaction costs in general are greatly reduced by the ability to find people. And I think it's true. I mean, I can see that in lots of contexts. I mean, maybe you people are too young to remember the Stone Age before Google and Amazon.com and such. But there are an awful lot of cases nowadays where there's something I want to buy that's sort of odd and obscure. And I say, well, it used to be that I would have had to keep searching and talk to people, and I probably would never have found it. Whereas now, you know, go up on the web and 10, 15 minutes, yep, there are three providers of it. So maybe that's an argument for saying that we ought to have less fair use, because if you want it, buy it. If you want the right to quote three sentences from my work, I'm easy to find. Just put the sentences in and it'll probably find me. With Google, and now you can just email me and say, do I have your permission? I'll offer you 50 cents to do it, and so forth. Yeah.
I think that runs into the problem you identified last time, was where you come up with a second derivative work, and then they take a look at it and you say, well, now that you've written it,
that's true. I agree. There are still some contractual problems with the fact that it might be that when somebody contacts me, I say, that's a very good idea. Why don't I do that? Well, on the other hand, there are an awful lot of cases where it doesn't, because after all, if what you want to do is to quote a chapter from my book in a book you're writing, I'm not going to write the book you're writing. And I actually do get some revenue, I think it's a fairly small amount, either from people who want to include an article I wrote in some book they're doing. More often, actually, I inherited intellectual property rights to some of my parents' works, and some of that shows up the same way. But nonetheless, nowadays it's a whole lot easier to get in touch with people than it used to be. So maybe that's an argument for shrinking fair use. A different point, which is coming up in a number of the discussions, and that's the idea of externalities, again, which Wendy Gordon, but I think someone else is, I think somebody else has the, or maybe it's some Wendy, someone has the book on the Kennedy assassination as a hypothetical example. So the question is, I'm not sure I've got her example or his example right, but it was something like somebody writes a intelligent, thoughtful book arguing that the Kennedy assassination was a plot by somebody. Don't care for LBJ is the obvious candidate, I suppose, since he's the one who ends up as president as a result, or by the CIA or by the Russians or by someone. And the argument is we ought to be more tolerant of his pushing the boundaries of copyright and quoting various other things in that, because that book provides the positive externality of informing the public. And it occurred to me that I wonder whether the argument then ought also to go in the other direction. Let us suppose somebody writes such a book, and I then want to write something quoting from that. Well, my ability to do that without paying him licensing fees reduces his incentive to have written that book in the first place. So maybe if you believe in this externality argument, you ought to say both that fair use is broader if the infringer is producing a positive externality, and that it's narrower if the infringed is producing a positive externality, because now we want even more to encourage to encourage what he's doing. Do people see any problem with this approach to fair use? Yep.
If I'm understanding correctly, so you look at a case-by-case basis as to whether it's a large or a priest?
You might do it case-by-case. You might try to craft rules. If you think about saying that one of the bases for fair use is educational uses. All right. The presumption there, I think probably a dubious presumption, but the presumption is that education produces net positive externalities. That's presumably the argument for subsidizing schooling. We hope education, maybe not, in lots of different contexts. So you could do it as a rule, or you could do it as the judge just saying. But can you see take the judge just saying it. Can you see the problem? Let's go back to that Kennedy book. What does the other judge say about that book? The first judge says, oh boy, this is a great book. It clearly increases our knowledge. It may even be right. What does the second book say? What does the second judge, what is another person's view of the same book offering a theory of how Kennedy was really assassinated? Boy, is this a nut job. This is a crazy conspiracy theory. It's just going to slander innocent people who did nothing wrong. It's going to confuse. People are going to read it and they aren't going to understand the real history. They'll believe this nonsense. Negative externality. Clearly we should enforce copyright law against it as strongly as we can. And why do we care if anybody pirates it? We'd rather have the guy not make any money anyway. All right? Putting it differently, Wendy's original argument for why you didn't produce this public good by having the government produce it is we can't trust the government to make the decision of what gets published. But every time you introduce the positive externality, you're letting a little bit of that back in, because you're now saying somebody, the legislature that makes the rules or the judge who is ruling on those rules, is implicitly deciding what books should or shouldn't get published there, because they're saying we're going to enforce the rules more or less stringently according to whether we believe this book has good or bad effects. So that, it seems to me, is the problem. Now, doesn't mean you can't do it, obviously. After all, the government does engage in lots of ways in doing the equivalent. The government puts out huge amounts of publications, so the government is not an outsider to this thing. The government gives people grants for doing research, so they're subsidizing ultimately certain kinds of publication. So maybe they shouldn't, I don't know, but at least in practice do. Another question which occurred to me, and I think it was probably reading Wendy's discussion, maybe one of the others, and that is, it's implied in a lot of the discussions that the person who doesn't want his stuff copied because it's criticizing him or parodying him, that somehow that's not a legitimate motive. Why isn't it? After all, if your criticism hurts me, if it helps other people, they ought to be willing to pay you for it enough so you're willing to pay me enough so I'll put up with the harassment. So what are the implicit assumptions in saying that the fact that you're doing something the author wouldn't like, which is sort of implicit in this sort of criticism, parody argument, that that's an excuse for violating his copyright? Right? The argument clearly is that the implicit argument, the argument is the economist's written argument would be, even if it's worth doing, he won't give permission. But why is that true? Because after all, shouldn't we count in worth doing the cost to him of being humiliated, or the cost, it may even be a cost that we approve of, that we regard as a cost. Consider the case, let me take a case of a book I read only a tiny bit of, which was called Board of the Rings. I read Lord of the Rings early enough that I had to wait for the second volume to be published. A very, very long time ago when I was very young. I probably read that book 20 times in my life and think very highly of it. Well, I think anybody who believes that the person who wrote a not very attractive parody of that doesn't deserve a penny is right. In fact, you should probably pay a fine to the rest of us for spoiling our fun or something. So it's not necessarily true that the unpleasantness to the original author of being parodied is somehow a base motive. It might be a motive that we agree with. But in any case, generally the law doesn't worry very much about base motives or noble motives. So why is it that we count it as particularly permissible to infringe a copyright when you're doing criticism? Why doesn't the standard rule, which say, add up what everybody on both sides is willing to pay, what the copyright holder is willing to pay means what he's willing to give up by refusing your offer to pay him for permission. All right, that's the measure of the value to the copyright holder of not being parodied is the price he charges for permission to be parodied. Does that make sense? All right, if you say to me, how much is it worth to you? Well, let me take a real example. How much is it worth to me to be able to sleep across the Pacific Ocean if I'm taking a trip to Australia? Well, the measure of that is the difference between what I'm willing to pay for a tourist class and for a first class or maybe business class nowadays. So one way of putting it that is, imagine the case, which doesn't usually happen actually, though maybe it should, where somebody says, I'm willing to pay you a first class ticket to Australia to come give a speech. And I say, well, that's very nice, but you know, the difference between first class and tourist class is really horrendous. How would you like to let me fly tourist class and pay me the difference? All right. What price I'm willing to accept, what money I'm willing to make that deal on is a measure of how much I dislike having to sit up on that long flight, which I would dislike. If only, actually I did do it a long, long time when I was young. The only time in recent time I've flown that far was to New Zealand, and it was business class at somebody else's expense, which was very pleasant. But I probably wouldn't do it at my own expense. I probably should, but I probably wouldn't. But going back, so if you think about, I'm the copyright holder. You want to write a book that is going to criticize or parody my book. A measure of how much I don't want to be criticized or parodied is what price I'll accept to give you permission to write that book, all right, to license it. Why doesn't that count in the calculus in deciding whether on net it's worth doing, along with the value to the people who will pay you to read the book, which is the measure of the positive value. So why shouldn't we say, if you're not willing to pay me a price I'm willing to accept, that's evidence that you're writing that parody does net damage, it hurts me more than it helps them, shouldn't do it. After all, that's our rule for everything else. If you think about the question, you think that you would like to turn my house into a hotel. It's a very nice house, lovely house, not too far from here. Doubtless there are students who'd like places to stay in. How do we decide you don't get to turn my house into a hotel? By the fact that I won't accept any price you'll offer. What price I'll accept is a measure of the value of the house to me, what price you offer to you. Yeah.
You're asking the author to predict what's worth it to value of the person.
Which author? The second author?
The
author of the parody or the copyright holder?
The copyright holder. Because you're saying that the second author wants to use the first author's
work. Right. And
the
first author doesn't have to predict how well the parody will sell. The second author has to predict that and decide how much he's willing to pay for permission to license it. The first author has to say, how much will it hurt me to have a parody written of my work?
I guess still that, I guess the author is in between negotiating what's the price.
Yes, right.
And then they would have first say on how much it is, how valuable it is. And then
the first author is deciding what price he will charge for permission to use his copyrighted material. And the lowest price he will charge, he might try higher if he thinks he can get it, but the lowest price he will charge will be what he sees as the humiliation of having it, the pain price to him of having somebody write a parody of his book. The highest price the other author will pay is the amount of money he believes he can make by writing that parody. If the highest price is higher than the other, they ought to be able to reach some agreement. If not, isn't that the right answer? Yeah?
I think the other implication that you are in all this is there are First Amendment implications because the courts are hesitant, the state is hesitant to limit expression. So by having copyright law taken into account, the value the original author has in limiting parody, there are very big First Amendment implications for that.
Why are they any different than taking into account any, that in general, First Amendment, I mean, this is one of the things that gets discussed, but we're going to get to it today, but in general, the First Amendment doesn't prevent copyright in general. So if you want to quote a chapter of my book in an anthology of writers writing on some subject or other, you still need my permission. Why isn't that just as much a violation of the First Amendment? Why is it special It's not like you can't, you as the critic can say my book is terrible. That doesn't require my permission at all. It's only when you want to quote chunks of it in order to prove it that we run into fair use issues.
True, but I mean, the ability to quote chunks of it could be vital to the expression.
Absolutely, but the ability to quote all of my chapter when you're not criticizing could be vital to the argument you're making, too. You want to make an argument about the development of law and econ theory in the U.S. over the last 30 years. All right, well, my chapter is a part of that. I think one of the authors we're reading was a student of mine. Pretty sure I remember that. So I'm not sure how, I mean, I agree that there's a whole issue of how the First Amendment and copyright intersect, along with how the First Amendment and defamation law intersect. I think you can argue in both cases that First Amendment prevents both of those, though that's not the court's position, obviously. But, yeah.
I think there's two problems with this. So one's the bilateral monopoly.
Bilateral monopoly, yeah. That's a problem.
Especially since the original author might overvalue this.
Ah, that's the bilateral monopoly, it seems to me, is going to apply to all of these cases, not just to the critical one. Right? I've got a monopoly of my book if you want to quote a chapter from it too. But no, the point I was wondering if people would get to is I want to go back to the Boulder and Levine book and its discussion of what? On patent law. Because the puzzle which that book doesn't really explain, but which it raises, is why didn't Watt license? Alright? Watt's got this great idea of the steam engine. Other people have improved versions. Why the devil didn't he make agreements with the other people so that they could implement their improved versions and give him a cut of the money? And yet he didn't. So one answer might be that this is a case where we don't really believe in rationality. We really say, you know, people are proud, sort of irrationally proud somehow, and therefore you say, whatever you'll pay me, I don't want to allow you to quote my book to show that I'm an idiot. Or to parody my book and make fun of this treasure of my heart that, you know, is so dear to me. So, which, of course, in a way gets into a different issue. If you think about the whole eminent domain question, you want to drive a highway through my house. And suppose the reason I won't sell is not that I'm trying to hold you up for a high price. It's that I really love my house. I grew up there. My parents grew up there. They didn't let it happen, but imagine they did. So the question is, does my almost infinite value count in the calculus? Am I allowed? Well, current law says it doesn't. Maybe it should. I don't know. I mean, why do we take that position? My almost infinite value for my heart does count when you want to claim that my heart is more valuable to somebody who's dying, who's much younger than I am, and therefore will live longer than I would have lived with my heart. All right, let me go on. We've got lots of neat stuff here. Any reactions to the Fisher article? Because that was a very different article, and there was a way in which I both liked it and disliked it. I liked it because he was honest, and I disliked it because he was honest about a position I strongly disagree with. Fisher is the one who thinks that we ought to decide what the world ought to be like and what other people ought to do, and then use the law to get them to do it. All right? So that he happens to know that people watch too much television. All right, somehow, divine inspiration, good philosophy, I don't know. He happens to know people don't do enough writing of derivative works. So if only we tweaked our law to make television less successful and to make it easier to write derivative works, people would live the kind of lives that Fisher knows human beings ought to live, in which they're being creative and productive instead of being couch potatoes. All right, he doesn't put it that way, but that's what he's really saying. And I am happy to see somebody who's honestly willing to say that, but I disagree. I don't think he is competent to figure out the lives other people ought to live, nor do I think he's got the right to. It reminds me in an odd way, although he's not as bad as that. There's a song that probably none of you have ever heard, it was a long time ago, about little houses made of ticky-tack. You do know it.
Yeah, it was on Weeds.
What?
It was the theme song for Weeds.
I see, so it's still around. And I am angry every time I think about that song. Because how the devil does the arrogant author of that song know the lives of the people living in those houses? He takes it for granted that if you have a house that looks to me sort of stereotyped and such, you must be a brain-dead vegetable. I mean, it's not, that's the real tone of it. For all I know, some of the people in those houses may be extraordinarily generous and kind people. They may be highly intelligent people. You just don't know. It's not the same thing, but I once heard a talk by Richard Feynman, who is one of the leading physicists of the last 50 years. He had a very strong, I think, Brooklyn accent. Listening to the voice, you say, an uneducated kid from the... All right, and this is a really first-rate intellectual. One of the nice things about America is we don't really have a class system. And therefore, if you're sufficiently smart, you can end up being a Nobel Prize-winning scientist without having gone to Exeter and Harvard and, you know, had an upper-class accent and stuff like that. But similarly here, it just seems... So that's sort of part of my reaction against Fisher. But on the other hand, at least he's honest about it. He makes it perfectly clear that he's got a picture of what the world ought to be like, and he's trying... And he's doing, it seems to me, a fairly intelligent job. For example, it occurs to him, as it does not occur to many other people, that if you're really in favor of equality, there's a lot to be said in favor of price discrimination. All right, discrimination sounds like a bad thing, but what's price discrimination? Well, one part of price discrimination, if you can do it, is charging rich people a high price and poor people a low price, because the poor people can't pay the high price and rather get a low price than nothing. All right, so from that standpoint, that was sort of neat. On the other hand, it seemed to me there was a very serious mistake he made, and I don't know if he could defend it or not. He's concerned with the fact that there are some professions that people will do even if they're very badly paid, all right, which might include novelists, include musicians, as it happens. Actor, all right. If you know anybody who's a would-be actor, they're willing to wait tables in order to be actors. I know that those people more or less. Well, his reaction is that he believes in equality, and therefore they shouldn't be allowed to drive wages down to the point where they are living on a very low income. And my answer is why? After all, why is money all that matters? You've got a choice of two lives. You can do what you really love doing, which is music. And, you know, eat rice and potatoes and beans. Or you can spend 40 hours a week doing a boring, soul-killing job that you hate and have a good, comfortable income. Which would you rather do? I think the answer is most people would rather do the first. So what business he saying that the people who end up having the jobs they really like should also have a pretty good income? Why? From his standpoint, if he believes in equality, why shouldn't part of equality be that if you get a job you really like, you get a very low salary? Doesn't that seem like the obvious sort of logical implication? How many people, by the way, are familiar with Rawls, who I think he touches on briefly? All right, Rawls is a very prominent political philosopher for reasons I've never been able to understand. And Rawls wrote a book which got a lot of attention, which proposed a standard sort of for the just society. And the standard for the just society was it did not have to be egalitarian, but you could only justify something that benefited people who were above the bottom if it also benefited the bottom. The way he put it was that the appropriate criterion for judging a society was how well off the worst off person was. And I have never found any argument for that position in Rawls or anywhere else. And I'm not sure whether even Rawls would continue to defend it, but it got a lot of attention. And it did at least have the virtue of being a definable position. All right, that it was the way he puts it is imagine that you're behind the veil of ignorance. Imagine that you're looking at possible societies and trying to choose among them, and you don't know who you're going to be. Well, he said, in that case, you're going to take the pessimistic assumption that you'll end up in the worst possible position, and therefore you want the society where the worst possible position is best. He never explains why you would make that assumption. Right? You could make the optimistic assumption that you'll be at the top. You could make what seems to me the natural assumption, which you have an even chance of being anybody. So therefore you want to maximize the average. And in fact, his veil of ignorance argument was made by another philosopher, Harsanyi, earlier, who came up with utilitarianism as the conclusion. Namely, you want to maximize the average welfare of the population because you don't know who you're going to be. But in any case, the reference to Rawls is there. Rawls is taken very seriously by political philosophers. I had a bit of an argument with some political philosophers online a while ago who are people with roughly my political views who say nice things about Rawls, and I basically wanted to know what excuse they had other than that they said rude things about Rawls, other professional academic philosophers wouldn't like them. Because it seemed to me they were willing to put down bad arguments by people on their political side, which is fine. but we're less willing than they should be to put down bad arguments, people on the other political side who were very respectable. Anyway, long digression. You can probably find that if you do a search for my name and Rawls and on web. It was a couple of months ago, an online debate. Anyway, let me go on to other things. One problem with Fisher's position, and it's one he might concede, I mean, Fisher strikes me as a pretty intelligent guy, I should say, even though I strongly disagree with him, is that if you use judges to redistribute, if you do, as he implicitly sort of seems to think, that judges should decide what the good society would be like and then tweak things to make it, that raises the stakes on who gets to be judge. And that makes it harder to appoint judges. And I may have mentioned in this class before John Lott's recent book on what's gone wrong with the process for appointing federal judges. That basically, by his account, if you just look at the data on how long approval takes, over the last couple of decades, the length of time to approve either appeals court judges or Supreme Court judges has increased a lot. Worse, according to him, if you look at the data, what's hardest is to get good judges approved. That what's going on is that if you're a Republican, you would rather not have liberal judges appointed. But if you're going to have liberal judges, you want them to be stupid liberal judges, because then they won't influence the judiciary. If you're a Democrat, you'd rather not have conservative judges. But if you have to have a conservative judge, you want it to be a stupid one. And he's got data. It turns out if you take very simple measures of the quality of applicants, such as did they go to a top law school? Were they on the law review? Did they clerk for either an appeals court judge or even better, a Supreme Court judge? Every one of those features that you add to a candidate increases how long it takes to get him approved. He's got the numbers on it. By how much percentage longer it takes to approve a well-qualified candidate than a poorly qualified candidate. And his argument, which I think is probably right, is not that this is, you know, a fault of either side, because they're both doing it. That it's a result of the fact that because the expansion of government regulatory authority has greatly increased the stakes for the judges, that more and more issues are really being decided by the judges rather than outside the political system or in Congress, that because you've had a big shift of power towards regulatory agencies, what's the restriction on regulatory agencies, lawsuits over what they can do, consequently the stakes are higher, so both sides are willing to fight harder to try to get the results they want. And he doesn't offer any suggestion of what you can do about it. I mean, obviously his suggestion is he'd like to cut down government a whole lot. I know his political views, but his point is just that given that you're not doing that, you've got this problem, and the result is he thinks that the average quality of federal judges is substantially lower than it would have been 20 or 30 years ago, which is interesting. Did I mention his particular, the AB, he doesn't think much of ABA recommendations, and he's got some pretty striking evidence that evidence after the fact, the two most qualified judges, federal appeals court judges, both got the lowest rating that the ABA gives when they were up for appointment, as judged by things like whether their cases get cited by other people later. Both of whom were prior to that law school professors with very high reputations, whose work also gets quoted a lot. Anyway, but it is a problem you have to think about from any side. It isn't limited to Fisher's view, but that any time that you want to shift authority to the judges, you ought to worry about the effect of that on the incentives, on the mechanisms that choose judges. Any time you want to shift authority to the legislature, you want to worry about the fact that that increases the incentive to spend resources trying to get. Anytime you want to shift resources to the president, and so forth. I mean, this isn't that I don't know what you do. I'm only saying that one ought to always, if you're thinking about sort of political changes, you ought to always have in mind the incentive implications of what you're doing, because we usually don't. We usually sort of imagine freezing everything and changing one thing, and that doesn't work in the real world, because it's an interdependent world. Different issue. The argument that we are willing to allow violations of copyright for educational uses, for desirable uses. How about violations of other property rights? Do we also believe that schools should be allowed to steal paper to print step one. Should schools be allowed to seize buildings and just say, all right, this building is now ours, we want to have a school there? Again, we don't believe that, right? So we mostly don't believe that. Sometimes we do. There's a little bit you've got eminent domain sometimes. But we don't generally say that property rights disappear when they're being violated for a good purpose. And so that again pushes us back on this question, which keeps showing up again and again, and I think it's going to show up as long as you're thinking about IP, of the tension between thinking about it as a natural right and thinking about it as a privilege that we give for desired purposes. You think about it as a natural right, you say, well, you want to subsidize education? That's what you got a tax system for. You don't subsidize education by saying schools get to steal my property. Whereas if you think of it as something other than that, it makes a lot more sense to do it that way. I think, let me check. Yeah, we're out of time. More stuff we can talk about, but we have another day to talk about more stuff. Am I correct in remembering that I didn't give you a reading assignment for Thursday that was going on the same reading assignment? I'd have to look at the syllabus. Same one. Yeah, good, because I've got another day's worth of stuff to talk about, I think. I thought this was one of the more interesting chunks, just in terms of a bunch of intellectually interesting issues that it raises for us to think about.